Hi, I'm Mark Brody, co-host of The Show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning. It's The Show here on KJZZ 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, we visit a jam session led by a national banjo champion. And comedian Cristela Alonzo is bringing her Upper Classy tour to the Valley. We'll hear from her about that. But first, it is time for the Friday newscap and some voices from the news this week.
The people of Arizona and this nation want more than words. They want results. They want politicians to treat the border as more than a convenient place for a photo op. They want leaders who will take action.
I really hope that what I'm proposing here grabs attention, because I do believe that in the name of election integrity, if we do have most of the ballots tabulated by election night, Arizona overall would be much better off.
We've got an attorney general right now in Chris Mays who won't enforce the transgender laws. It's just say that a boy can wake up on any given day and want to go and compete against my daughters.
It's a sad mistake on the part of people. She's a wrong person. But no, I haven't encouraged her, and I haven't had discussions up with her about it.
The majority of those voters were taking up time from my staff to serve the voters who actually needed those ballots.
Our team has done a phenomenal job. You look at just 10 days to deal with a large turnout, two different ballots.
And joining me to talk about a settlement in the defamation lawsuit brought by Maricopa County Recorder Stephen Richer against Kerry Lake, speculation already starting about the 2026 elections and more, are Matthew Benson of Veritas. Good morning, Matt.
Good morning.
And Sam Richard of Consilium Consulting. Sam, good morning to you.
Good morning.
So, guys, let's start with the defamation lawsuit. Stephen Richer had sued Kerry Lake. She basically chose not to contest it. That was a little while back. This week, there was a settlement in that case. We do not know the details of it. Matt, do you have a sense of, I mean, none of us are lawyers, so we'll throw that out there. But politically, what's the benefit of settling this?
Well, politically, the benefit for Kerry Lake is discovery ends, all of the communications that she's had internally with her campaign regarding Stephen Richer in the county won't see the light of day. And I'm assuming there was a lot in there that she didn't want to share. So it's really fascinating, and it's become a pretty big mystery in Arizona politics, because, like you say, the terms of that settlement are not disclosed.
What's the bigger mystery? What might have been in that communication, or how much money she might be giving him?
Well, how about both? Okay. Because I think everybody, there's an assumption that Stephen Richer receives some sort of a payout here, but we don't know.
Right. Sam, what do you make of the fact that this is how this is all ending?
I'm just happy that it's ending, because I don't think there was a lot of question that what was alleged, you know, probably happened, right? It still isn't, right? But the concept that it's over and it's behind us, I think, not just is very positive for the two individuals at the center of the conversation, but also the broader community. We can look past these personal squabbles and actually get back to talking about, you know, the work of the recorder.
Do you see, Sam, this settlement in some way, maybe a continuation of what we saw recently from Kerry Lake, where she kind of sort of conceded, she put out a video kind of acknowledging she didn't win the race? Like, is this maybe part of that effort just to move beyond all the election denialism stuff?
I think it's absolutely an effort and a potential swing of the bat to try to move beyond that in a very tidy way. But I'm not sure that if she does re-enter electoral politics that either her primary opponents or her general election opponents are going to let her forget her behavior of the past 4 years.
Yeah, I mean, Matt, even though the stuff that was in that communication won't see the light of day, I mean, a lot of people kind of have a sense of what she had to say and what she thought about things.
Yeah, well, yes, there's no mystery what Kerry Lake thinks about things. I think, you referenced the video that she did following the Senate race here, and if you saw an acknowledgement in that video that she didn't win the race, I mean, you're a smarter guy than I, because I didn't see any sort of concession there. I thought it was more of a promotional video on her part.
It was more a matter of not saying that she did win than acknowledging that she didn't.
Sure. Yeah. Half a point for her on that.
Yeah. I mean, putting your king down doesn't make it checkmate, but you still lost the match, right? So, I mean, I don't know. I'm with Matt on this one.
The real question is, what is she going to do now? And, you know, spinning this forward to 2026, does she join the Trump administration in some capacity? Does she do something to kind of get her by, because she does need a job of some sort, until the next cycle? And then in that cycle, does she run for governor or something else? And, you know, the only person who knows the answer to that is Carrie Lake.
What do you think, though? I want to ask both of you really quickly before we move on from this. Do you think she runs for office again in Arizona, Matt?
I think she's done.
Sam, what do you think?
I hope so. I hope that she returns to private citizenship, and that's the only place that she stays. I think that she's proven over a handful of cycles that she does not belong on a ballot, and she is not a good steward of the public trust in any way.
All right. So let's move to Maricopa County Supervisor Tom Galvin, somebody who did win his election this November. He's proposing some changes to election administration. The one that's sort of getting the biggest amount of attention is cutting off an earlier cutoff date for dropping off early ballots. That, of course, is one of the reasons why it takes so long here. People drop off their ballots on election day or right before election day. Then those signatures have to be verified. It just takes a little while. Is this something, Sam, that you think there might be some amount of support for, even among Democrats?
Yeah, I think that this definitely fits in the bucket of something that feels like a common sense solution. You know, we have a muscle memory now of early voting. So if you have that ballot, you maybe can understand philosophically the trade-off. If you get this ballot mailed to you, you have to return it before Election Day. I also think that we now have an entire election cycle under our belts post-conspiracy theory that proved that democracy works. We had incredible turnout across the state of Arizona. Maricopa County returned complete results well ahead of its schedule that it put out. So I think that the conspiracy theories have a lot shorter of a stick now, and I think that the conversations around common sense solutions should be centered around what Mr. Galvin has here.
Is this one of those that you think Governor Hobbs will think is common sense? Because she's come out pretty hard and said, look, if anything restricts voting, I'm not going to support that.
Yeah, I think that there is not necessarily a portfolio that's going to come from Supervisor Galvin that Governor Hobbs is going to be a full-throated supporter of. But I don't think that this is something that she's necessarily or her administration is going to get in the way of either.
Matt, do you think that this is something that could get some momentum at the legislature beyond just Republicans?
Among Democrats, I think you'll find some, a handful anyway, that will support something like this. And I think what'll be interesting here is, you know, there may be an in-between ground. Everybody talks about Florida. What they don't talk about is that Florida does have day of mail-in ballots that can be dropped off. You just can't do it anywhere. In Arizona, you can drop off those ballots at any polling place, any vote center. In Florida, you can only do it at a handful of locations, at the county clerk's offices themselves. So they get far fewer election day mail-in drop-offs than, you know, we get hundreds of thousands typically in Maricopa County alone. And that is the biggest reason that, that results end up delayed. And so, you know, you could see sort of a compromised position here. Whether Governor Hobbs goes along with that or not, I don't know. But I think that there's no question there's a lot of momentum to try to reduce that period of time. Supervisor Galvin's talking about his goal is to have up to 95% of the vote counted by the end of election night.
Right.
And so, you know, if that's what you had, most races – We would know kind of what that result was. There's always a handful that are too close, and you're going to have to wait to see in the days that follow. But most races, you're going to know by the end of election night.
I wonder, Matt, how you see the conversation coming up, starting in January at the legislature, about proposed changes to election administration, given, as what Sam referenced, we're sort of not hearing a lot of the conspiracy theories. The canvass at the Maricopa County, like a lot of the supervisors commented about how there's almost nobody there and certainly nobody yelling at them and being angry with them for what happened. So I wonder if folks might be a little more amenable to making changes sort of outside the realm of people spewing conspiracy theories.
Yeah, I hope so. I think a lot of the anger has kind of dissipated. And I think the election denier crowd has become increasingly marginalized in this state. And you know, even with Carrie Lake losing this election, you're not hearing her vocalize that it was stolen. You're not really hearing many of her, you know, bigger supporters claiming the election was stolen. there's always some voices that are going to be out there on the left and right in this, you know, saying that something was up. But I think a lot of that energy has kind of has dissipated, and hopefully, in the wake of that, we can find some solutions that build upon. I mean, we have Arizona has an outstanding election process in this state.
Mm-hmm.
The counties do an outstanding job, but it's not perfect. It's never going to be perfect, and there are always things that we can improve on. And I think that's what Supervisor Galvin and other voices are trying to accomplish.
Yeah, Sam, I wonder if it becomes easier to make some of these changes when you don't have people saying the election was rigged, the election was stolen. More a matter of the election went smoothly, we can make it go even more smoothly, maybe.
Absolutely. I mean, here we are 2.5 weeks, plus or minus a few days after the election, and we're talking about sensible reforms and starting the conversation, kind of setting that frame. And kudos to Supervisor Galvin for, you know, kind of using this space to launch into that. We're not talking about Sharpies. We're not talking about bamboo ballots. You know, we're really actually, to Matt's point, talking about on the margins of our already, you know, high bar setting standards in our county recorder's offices, what they can do to be even 1% better tomorrow.
Yeah. And last I heard, California was still counting ballots.
They certainly are. And I guess, Matt, the big question is, as Sam referenced, do you think the changes that we might be looking at kind of around the margins as opposed to whole scale, you know, big time changes?
Well, I think the legislature is going to go for bigger wholesale changes. If, for example, you cut off early voting on the Friday before the election and move to more of a Florida-style system, that would be a significant switch for hundreds of thousands of voters. Arizona can do that, but you're going to need a change in the law, and you're going to need the state to provide the counties the ability to get more voting locations, more polling locations on election day, and more equipment. Because you're going to need, if you're going to say suddenly 200,000 or 300,000 people who've been dropping off their ballots on election day are now going to be voting in a line on election day, you're going to need a lot more locations so the polling places don't get overrun.
Yeah, that is interesting. All right, that is Matthew Benson, Sam Richard. I'm Mark Brody. The Friday Newscap continues in just a moment. Good morning. It's the Friday Newscap on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. My guest this week, Sam Richard of Conciliating Consulting and Matthew Benson of Veritas. Sam, let me start with you on this. Politico reported this week that Secretary of State Adrian Fontes is not ruling out a primary challenge to Governor Katie Hobbs. The Republic later spoke with him, and he kind of confirmed that. Do you think that Katie Hobbs is going to have a smooth sailing to the general election?
Listen, I think that Election Day was a wake-up call for anyone on the Democratic Party team, and I think that a lot of people are considering what 2 years from now looks like, what 4 years looks like from now. So I'm not surprised either that Secretary of State Fontes put up this test balloon. Neither am I surprised that will I be surprised when he's not the only one that does that. That being said, Governor Hobbs has never lost an election in her political career here in Arizona. She has done what she could do with a very adversarial state house led by Speaker Toma and a state Senate led by President Peterson over the course of the last 2 years. But for all intents and purposes, we have a fresh slate heading into January 13th of 2025, which is when the next legislative session opens. I think it is too early to be seen what she does with this new reality. I think that there are all options on the table, and I think that there's a real opportunity for her to plant a flag down and say that we do have a mandate to govern in a post-partisan way. Arizona elected me with roughly the same number of votes that elected a Republican majority in the state Senate. Let's get to work in a bipartisan fashion. Maybe I don't want to see a bill reach my desk unless it has a Democratic co-sponsor. Something bold like that, that really pushes the conversation into an arena that it hasn't been in, you know, memory here in Arizona.
Matt, it does feel a little weird to be talking about 2026 when the canvas for 2024 was just yesterday. But, I mean, we presume that there will be some number of Republicans running for governor. It's basically an open primary for them. Do you think that there will be a competitive primary for governor on the Democratic side as well?
I do. And Democrats hate competitive primaries. I just enjoy having this conversation because usually it's on the Republican side that we have this some knockdown, dragout primary. And, you know, finally on the Democrat side, I think we're going to see that on the Democrat side for governor. It's clear that the Secretary of State and the Attorney General both are looking pretty closely at that race. I think they deem that Governor Hobbs is vulnerable, and they're not wrong. Now, the fact that she's vulnerable doesn't mean they ultimately get into that race. There's a lot of calculations there. Can they raise money? Can they get the kind of support they need without just damaging themselves, without splintering the party? And can they ultimately be successful? It is difficult to beat an incumbent, and particularly difficult to beat an incumbent of your own party in a primary. Almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as we saw with Joe Biden this past cycle, incumbency ain't all it used to be. I think voters, if they think that Katie Hobbs is going to get beat in a general election, they will be very open to challengers who might go after her in a primary.
How much do either of you think what happens on the federal level might impact this one way or the other? I mean, we know that Katie Hobbs, for example, was helped a great deal while she was Secretary of State, defending the state's elections and defending the integrity of the elections from people like former president, now president-elect Trump. Is it naive to think that depending on what then President Trump will do, soon to be President Trump does, and how Governor Hobbs responds to that will have an impact here?
I think that the response is absolutely just as, if not more important than the action that President-elect Trump takes, regardless of the specific policy we're talking about. But even more so, what I'd point to is that historically, right, if we look at the numbers, this does look like something where it's a tough road to climb for a Republican challenger to an incumbent Democratic governor, the opposite party of who's in the White House, right? Arizona has a history of doing that. So I think that statistically there's that. But I think one of the things that Democrats are kind of faced with after this election cycle is conventional wisdom was anything but conventional this last cycle. So maybe we throw out everything and we start from scratch on a clean whiteboard and say, here's the path to victory.
Matt, do you think that whatever President, soon to be President Trump does, maybe it's on the border, maybe it's on the economy, maybe it's on something else that we haven't thought of yet, and how Governor Hobbs responds to it, does that impact whether or not other Democrats get into the race and maybe how strong Governor Hobbs is in re-election?
Of course. Yeah, what Trump does, his relative popularity going into the midterm, and Governor Hobbs's response, of course, those are probably the biggest factors this next cycle. Typically, that political pendulum kind of swings back and forth. And so Republicans had a big year in 24, and Democrats hope and expect to have a big year in 26. Doesn't mean it's going to happen. I mean, the biggest change politically has been Republicans just have this massive voter registration advantage right now. I mean, almost 300,000 registered voters. Mm-hmm. That's big. Democrats got to get out there and change the math equation there, or else they're going to have a really difficult time with that governor's race and each of the races down ballot in a couple of years. That's a lot of votes to make up for.
So go ahead.
And another wrinkle that I'll just throw out there is that next cycle, we will see this new kind of function of a lieutenant governor. So whether the incumbent governor or the Republican challenger will have kind of a slate mentality. So maybe the candidate is who we want as the candidate for governor, but maybe there's an identification of a lieutenant governor that maybe answers some questions that are left open by the candidate themselves.
All right. So way too early prediction. Sam, will there be more candidates in the governor's race in the primary on the Republican side or the Democratic side?
Ooh, Republican side.
Okay.
Hard stop.
Republican side. Matt, what do you think?
Yeah, yes. On the Republican side, as always, the biggest factor in that race is going to be, can the Republicans put up a candidate for the November general election that can win? And too often in recent cycles, the answer to that has been no.
All right. So you got, Sam, you mentioned, both of you actually mentioned Attorney General Chris Mayes. It looks like she has already had one for sure, one possible challenger on the Republican side. Rodney Glassman says he'll run for AG. Senate President Warren Peterson says he's thinking about it. Obviously, it's early yet. I mean, as we said, we just canvassed 2024 yesterday. I'm curious, Matt, what you make of one person for sure getting in and one person saying, yeah, I'm really thinking about it hard right now.
Yeah, well, the 2026 cycle has already begun, so I'm not surprised at all. I think you're going to see multiple candidates between now and spring you're going to see multiple candidates getting into the into these races, that the governor, attorney general, secretary of state on down the line. So I'm not surprised. I mean, look at how crowded that primary was for attorney general last time around.
Yeah.
You're going to see something similar this time.
Sam, when you talk about Governor Hobbs potentially being vulnerable, I mean, Chris May is only won by less than 300 votes.
That's
I would
right.
imagine Republicans are looking at that and saying, we basically almost won that last time in a year that was not great for Republicans. I wonder what 2026 is going to look like.
Yeah, I think that there's a lot of conversations and questions like that, absolutely. And I think that, to Matt's point, we are, you know, we canvassed the election results, so we're already looking to early November of 2026. Every conversation is focused on that.
Matt, when you look at these two candidates, obviously there will probably be more, and we don't know if President Peterson is for sure getting in. You have somebody who has run many races before, not won a ton of them, somebody who is a legislative leader, but, you know, a state legislator, not somebody who's necessarily super well-known outside of their district. Assuming it's just those two, and it won't be, but for right now, it's those two. How do you see that race shaping up?
Between Mays and—
No,
and
between the primary race, between Glassman and Peterson.
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, Warren Peterson has the advantage there. I mean, I think Rodney Glassman is, you know, always kind of self-funds or puts a lot of his own money into those races, and he'll have a financial advantage, at least on paper. But I think Warren Peterson would have a lot of the party behind him. And I just think Rodney Glassman brings a lot of baggage to this race, having run multiple races, sometimes as a Democrat, sometimes as a Republican. And Sam knows what I'm talking about.
I think, yeah, we were chatting earlier. I think the only primary that Mr. Glassman's ever won was a Democratic primary.
Well, he ran for U.S. Senate against John McCain.
That's right.
Is Warren Peterson enough to clear the field? Like, if he says, I'm in for AG, do other Republicans, like high-profile Republicans, get in, or do they stay out because of him, do you think, Matt?
Oh, I don't think that anybody's clear in that field. There's going to be lots of folks that look at that race, and I expect a large field of Republicans to be looking to run for attorney general.
And Sam,
especially, yeah. By the way, especially if there's this notion out there that Chris Mays, it might be an open seat. You know, if Chris Mays does ultimately run for governor, then you've got an open seat there to go for.
Yes, I want to ask you about that, too. Like, if Mays decides, let's say, and she has said that she's looking to run for re-election. She has not said that she is looking to run for governor. But let's say she changes her mind and does run for governor. Are there Democrats out there who are looking at that race saying, yeah, I guess I could do that, too?
Without question, I think that there are a lot of folks that are in the legal space that are registered Democrats who are highly qualified, who have been attorneys a lot longer than either of the two names that we mentioned earlier in the Republican primary have been attorneys and practicing law. So I think that there's an opportunity absolutely for those seats to be just as competitive down ballot as well. Obviously, the attention is on the gubernatorial race because that was where the political article was focused here. But we're going to have really kind of an internal navel-gazing period as a Democratic Party over the course of the next 6 months to a year, trying to figure out what our future is. And I think the natural result of those conversations is going to be people raising their hand and saying, I'm an expression of that future. You should elect me. And I think that in challenging incumbency, to Matt's point from earlier in the conversation, is absolutely something on the table.
Interesting. Mario, I'll have to leave it there. Sam Richard, Matthew Benson, thanks, guys, for coming in. Thanks for the conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good morning. It's the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Coming up, our new Soapbox essay series is all about giving thanks. But first, Cristela Alonso has done a lot of things in the entertainment world. She's the first Latina to create, write, and star in her own sitcom called Cristela. She's been a guest host on the daytime talk show The View. She voiced the character Cruz Ramirez in the film Cars 3. And tomorrow night, she's bringing her new stand-up tour called Upper Classy to the Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. The show is a follow-up to her two previous stand-up tours, Lower Classy and Middle Classy. The first two include stories from her life and family and ascending in class as she grows up. Alonso says she's a big fan of trilogies, even though she says it's a happy accident that these specials ended up as one. I spoke with Alonso earlier and asked about the process of not only coming up with jokes for a set, but then winnowing it down for a special.
Well, you know, I love the process. I love the writing of it. I love everything about it. I consider myself a little meticulous when it comes to my approach because I literally, I have recorded every set I've ever done in my life.
Wow.
And I do it because you never know as a comic what comes out of your mouth that the audience might laugh at, that might be a new idea. So every time that I'm up on stage and I throw something new that I thought the audience responded to, I will go to my, you know, back to my hotel room or back to my place. I'll listen to the set I just recorded and I'll transcribe it. And, you know, that's kind of, you know, but I also write in notebooks because to me, writing out the jokes helps me memorize it better.
Ah.
So now, right now, I'm doing about an hour 20, hour 30 on stage, depending on, you know, the mood. And I whittle down the 20 minutes that I'm not going to shoot in the special. So I try to see what hits the hardest, what can be tightened up. It's like writing on a TV show, except that I have a long time. I give myself a long time for the finished product to be ready.
So your specials and your previous two tours have dealt with, in large part, your own life and your experiences and growing up and, mm-hmm. you know, sort of becoming an adult. What is the balance for you in terms of being able and okay to tell jokes about your family and about your own experiences and like maybe things that are maybe too personal or maybe off limits to tell on stage?
Yeah, you know, to me, I think the important thing is to always talk about things that I think are interesting that people might be surprised they have in common with me. And to me, it's like, you know, people always ask me like, well, why do you talk about your family? I'm like, because I know them really well.
Mm.
You know, it's like, why do you talk about yourself? Because I know me very well. You know, it's like, it's just something that has always been part of my family dynamic, especially with my mom and my family. They're all storytellers. That's how we communicate. So for me, when I started doing stand-up, it was organic. It was just inevitable that I would talk about myself in stories. And what's funny is that medium, that form of stand-up really connected with people, which, I mean, I guess is the goal, but I never thought about it. To me, stand-up was always about doing the thing I loved. I never really thought like, well, what will the audience think is funny? I always approach it as, well, I think is funny. Let's see who agrees with me. And those are my people.
I mean, it's kind of an interesting scenario that you find yourself in on stage, right? Because it's just you, right? And a microphone and maybe a stool and some water. And then yes. All these people who are staring at you waiting for you to make them laugh. So it's in some ways, I would imagine it can feel very isolating. But as you say, it's also about trying to bring people in and like you want them to laugh at something you're saying. So you have to sort of engage with them, even though you're sort of isolated from them.
Yeah, well, you know, and I actually think that, you know, I actually see stand-up as a conversation. Mm. I really feel like the audience, when they laugh, that's part of their conversation.
Have you run into situations where family members have either before the fact or after the fact said, please don't tell that, or I wish you hadn't told that?
No, and actually, you know, I think it's also, I think that I am very respectful of my family. So my rule is I never say anything if it's not true, but I also don't want to tell any stories that would paint them in a negative light because I love my family and they're the most important thing for me.
Have you found that you have learned anything about yourself or like realized things maybe about your childhood during the course of talking about it and writing material about it?
Oh my God, yes. You know, it's a weird thing. When you're a child, you think that your childhood is what life is like for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You are in a bubble. This is your world. And I think that I've learned a couple things throughout just doing my stand-up and talking about my experiences. And one of them is not everyone had my childhood, meaning that, you know, I had a very hard upbringing. You know, we lived in poverty, you know, immigrant family. We are not the quintessential family that you would see on a sitcom, even though I had my own, right? You know, but it's this thing where like, I've learned that my childhood and where I come from is very specific to me. But at the same token, you realize that when you're specific about your life and when you're able to tell details about, when you can paint a picture about what's happening, you actually see that so many people connect with you, even though they didn't come from the same background. And I think that one big thing that I've learned, that I'm still learning, is how I'm playing catch up on life the older that I get and the more I ascend. You know, meaning that, like, for example, going to a doctor, right? Like, I found out I was diabetic about 10 years ago, and I had to learn how to go to the doctor because my family didn't have money to go to the doctor. We didn't have checkups. We didn't do anything, you know? So I realized that even in my 40s, I feel like a child sometimes, having to learn all this stuff kind of on my own, you know? And that's what I think is so interesting, though, is that so many of us actually have those issues, whether it might be health insurance or something else. There's a lot of us that didn't do certain things when we were younger that now we have to learn how to do as adults. And it can be eye-opening, and it could be surprising, and it can be frustrating, but it can also be hilarious.
Yeah, I was going to say, all that sounds like kind of a gold mine for comedy.
Absolutely. I mean, look, it's like, yeah, I mean, you know, it's like my last special, I did a joke about how I found out I was diabetic. I went to the gynecologist. She told me, like, you know, it was like this thing where, like, I went to the gynecologist because I was just like, I got health insurance. I'm like, oh, I'm going to go get a checkup. I didn't even know what checkups were. Like, you know, I even say it. I'm like, you know, checkups are like when people with money go to the doctor just for fun, right? That's what a checkup is, right? So I go to the gynecologist because she's the first doctor that would see me. And I had no idea. I had never been to one. And I didn't know what they did. And I get to the doctor's office and I realize what she does. And I'm just like, oh my God, like, that's your area of expertise? Like, you know what I mean? Like, oh my God. Like, you know, I even make a joke about it. I'm like, how do you know it's sick? I've never heard it cough. Like, you know what I mean? And it's like, you know, which is true. That is how, you know, like, you know, I found out I was diabetic from the gynecologist because of my urine sample. You know, it's a story and truth, but it's ridiculous the way that I had to find out. And having done stand-up for so long, I'm able to see that that's the funny of it.
All right. Well, Chriselle Alonzo, thank you so much for your time, and good luck on the rest of your tour. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
The Valley is full of avant-garde musicians exploring the farthest frontiers of rock and roll, but there are also plenty of artists keeping the flame of old-time music alive. The show's Sam Dingman met one of them earlier this year.
Every Monday at 1 p.m., there's a bluegrass jam session at the Pyle Adult Recreation Center in Tempe. People come for all sorts of reasons.
I'm learning how to play the banjo, and it's just really fun. I've really improved my playing, and I love the songs, and I love singing, and it's just a really fun thing to do.
They're not all perfect at it. They're learning like I'm trying to.
I pretty much eat, sleep, and play bluegrass all day long.
At the jam, everybody sits in a circle. On the day I visited with producer Amber Victoria Singer, there were at least 5 banjo players, 6 guitars, a handful of mandolins, plus an electric bass and a keyboard. The jam runs for 3 hours with no breaks, and it's led by a guy named Bruce Wurst.
You guys say we are a little jazzy here.
Once in a while.
We do have the blues from grass.
I first read about Bruce on the website for a store called Music Masters in Scottsdale. Bruce is a teacher there, and his bio is pretty impressive. This is the part that caught my eye. Bruce holds over 250 first place trophies for banjo, guitar, fiddle, and mandolin. He is a national banjo champion and an 8-time Arizona State guitar champion. When he is not teaching music, Bruce is either tuning pianos, repairing pianos, teaching woodworking, or flight instruction at the different airports in North Phoenix. I read that and I thought, I gotta meet this guy. But when we arrived at the jam, the first thing Bruce did was introduce us to everybody else.
So we have Sam over here, and we have Amber behind most of you over there. So they're going to walk around. If they tap you on the shoulder, they just want to talk to you. So
apologies in advance for interrupting your playing.
The music started up again. Amber and I started tapping people on the shoulder.
Bruce is awesome.
He keeps giving me ideas, and he's very encouraging. So he's a great jam instructor and a great teacher.
He even included us in introductions, which is, you know, and we're not even, you know, in the group. We just came to listen.
When you ask Bruce Wurst to introduce himself, he doesn't bring up the trophies or the banjo championships, not to mention woodworking or flight school.
My name's Bruce Wurst. I guess I'm just a normal musician here in the Phoenix area.
He will tell you, however, that his goal with the bluegrass jam is simple.
I try to help everybody out that I can help out.
Don't you start.
Back in the circle, a man in shorts and a baseball cap is standing in the center of the group with his guitar. He's bent low at the waist, leaning into the lyrics of Lost Highway. When the song ends, he introduces himself as Scott Baker, or, as they call him at the jam, Scotty B. Scotty B's baseball cap has a Bible verse printed on it.
My inspiration really comes from, it's come kind of a heavenly realm. It's almost downloaded some way.
Another guy shows up a few minutes late. He stands quietly, listening to the music for a while, and then starts unpacking his guitar. He tells me he met Bruce at another jam session in Glendale, and then he started coming to this one too.
I just like the camaraderie and to be with other people that play music. I'm alone. My wife died a year ago, and I've got all my instruments, and that's what I'm doing now is playing music, and I don't really care what the genre is. I just want to play music and enjoy life with people.
As Amber and I move around the circle, my eyes keep drifting to the keyboard player, who looks to be the oldest person in the group by far. Eventually, I make my way over and sit down next to him.
What's your name, sir?
I'm Ed Wurst.
And is Bruce your son?
Yes. No, he's my father.
So, how long have you guys been playing music together?
Since he's 2 and a half. And I've been playing since I'm about 5. And I'm 92 now.
You're 92.
Yeah.
So one of the other things that was really incredible about coming to the jam was that I got to meet your dad.
Uh-huh.
And he told me that you have been playing music since you were...
Three. Well, he's a music teacher, and all us kids had to actually play.
Uh-huh.
So myself, I started on guitar. I did piano and saxophone.
At three?
At three.
How many siblings do you have?
I have a brother and a sister.
Brother and sister. So between the three of you, at this young age, you were playing 9 instruments?
At least, yes. Every summer when school got out, I mean the day school got out, we jumped in the motorhome. We left until school started back up in September.
And where would you go?
We would go anywhere. Every place we went, we would find some place we could put a show on.
A music show?
Yeah, a music show.
So you had a proper family band?
Yeah, we did have a family band. It was my brother, my sister, and myself. And we used to travel all around. We started hitting national parks. And this was in the early 80s when the national parks didn't have the money to run the programs. And we used to go in there and find the person in charge. Hey, would you like a little show? Since nothing's happening, and they said, well, come on over, we'll set you up, and we started playing in national parks all over the West.
Would people give you guys money?
Yeah, we would actually get money. Mm-hmm. The national parks would set it up that they'd actually give us a free spot to stay. One park would call up the next, hey, you know, we're going to send these guys over to you, and so we started following these parks all summer long.
Wow.
We used to love Bryce Canyon. We loved Zion. We played in Grand Tetons. We played in Yellowstone. 2 weeks here, 2 weeks there.
What other venues did you play?
Oh, we used to go by, and one of the places we really liked to go was up to like Silverton and Durango. They had all the coffee shops downtown. We'd just go in, hey, you want some music today? Oh, come on in and play.
I'm tempted to ask, did any of this ever feel
like an imposition, or was it something you guys took to?
We loved it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Every day was different.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
It wasn't the same thing every single day.
Yeah. I mean,
I know where we're going to be. When we got tired of one place, we left and went to the next place.
When I first read about Bruce, I was sort of surprised that such an accomplished musician would want to run a weekly jam session. Not that there's anything wrong with jam sessions. I guess I just assumed that someone with his level of accomplishment would want to play with other, well, banjo champions. But when Bruce said that thing about never wanting 2 days to be the same, it occurred to me that that's the reason Bruce himself comes to the bluegrass jam. And that maybe it's why he's able to create this space that can be so many different things to so many different people. Bluegrass music, he says, is about letting music be whatever it needs to be.
If you do a song the same way twice in a row, you should probably quit. That's something Dad always said.
Uh-huh.
Yep. It should be different every single time you play it.
And for Bruce, it is.
Let's see what I can actually play today. Let's put it that way. Let's see here. Interesting. I got a buzz in here today. We'll work the buzz.
Why did it feel important to you to have your kids play music?
I just want to have another language.
Another language?
Yeah, that's what you look at it. I mean, I spend hours every day just playing to entertain myself. I don't have to watch TV. You know, you're not going to be a millionaire, but it's fun. It's a great life. And I'm still alive, so I can't complain.
Beautiful.
Right now, the problem is if you ask me to play that again, I wouldn't be able to do it.
Right. That's Bruce Wurst on the banjo. For KJZZ's The Show, I'm Sam Dingman.
Good morning. It's The Show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Mark Brody. Tis the season to be grateful, and that's why our latest Soapbox essay collection is all about giving thanks. This time, we invited students of high school English teacher Carrie Deal for their take on the theme. Deal has taught for 26 years, currently at Alhambra High School in West Phoenix. Deal loves memoir assignments. They believe this gives students an opportunity to take risks in their writing, which leads to better storytelling. Over the next week, we'll be hearing from four of Deal's students, beginning today with ninth grader Sierra Espinoza.
I am grateful. I am grateful for my lovely great Nana. She chose my name, took care of me, raised, fed, and held me as I grew. My favorite memory with my Nana, whose name is Josie, was when I was 6. I was climbing our olive tree to get the soccer ball my friend kicked. As I climbed and got extremely high, I heard cracking. The branch that I was on started to crack and break. My Nana, who was gardening, heard me screaming and crying for her help. She told me to jump, but I couldn't out of fear. Irritated, she hit the branch with a gardening tool. Sadly, when the branch broke, she didn't catch me, and I fell. Luckily, I didn't break or sprain anything, just a few cuts and bruises. My Nana took care of my rooms. After, we went to bed. I always slept with her, no matter the circumstances, until I was 12, when she passed away. I love my Nana and the time we shared. I loved it when we cooked together, especially when we made our favorite fruit salad. She will always be my great-grandma, my caretaker, and my mother. I am grateful for all the time I was given with her, the way she taught me, and for being able to call her my Nana. I am grateful.
That was Alhambra High School student Sierra Espinoza. You can hear that essay and more from past Soapbox collections at kjzz.org. That's it for this episode of The Show Podcast. To find out more about the stories from today or other episodes, visit theshow.kjzz.org. And you can subscribe to KJZZ's The Show on your favorite podcasting site. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening today.